Here he is with 9 stone 12, 136 pounds as a four-year-old in the Melbourne Cup of 1930. 10,000 pounds sterling that race was worth, and the best stayers in Australia were engaged, but Firelap simply played with them. Aye, it's like he's taking candy from a baby. Firelap wins.
He's a phenomenal galloper. I think the best horse I've ever seen and ever rode.
The Red Terror, the greatest horse in the world.
In 1930, Firelap won 11 races in 11 weeks. Nothing compares with that.
We're going to lose you, and we're going to miss you. Good luck, Firelap. Australia's with you.
Going to America, Firelap was sent into the most treacherous racing environment that has ever existed.
But Firelap's got it. Come on, Firelap. Firelap, you beauty.
And then, at the height of his racing career, Firelap suddenly dies.
The Yanks killed him.
I rang Dad and said, oh, I'm going to Canberra. I said, I'll have a look at Firelap's heart while I'm there. And that's when he said, well, that'll be clever because it's not Firelap's heart, it's draft horses. Well, I just said to him, are you joking?
All the evidence is right there in front of us, in plain sight. I'm Kerry Negara, and this is Killing Firelap, a forensic investigation. Episode 3, April 5th, 1932. In the arms of criminals at Atherton on the San Mateo Peninsula, San Francisco, California, USA, a tragedy unfolds. Back to that fateful day on April 5th, as Firelap died an agonising death, when he took his last breath and hemorrhaged pain-laden blood all over his devoted handler Tommy Woodcock, Firelap's killers were close by. Without warning, the wonderful relationship between Firelap and Tommy Woodcock ended abruptly on 5th of April 1932 at 2:20 p.m. at the Perry Stables in Menlo Park, Atherton, where Firelap was being rested after his awe-inspiring win by a massive 2 furlongs in the much-hyped Agua Caliente handicap in Tijuana, Mexico. Two autopsies delivered two different conclusions. The first autopsy was issued directly after the two vets, Bill Nilsson and Cesare Macero, witnessed firsthand the state of Firelap's stomach and delivered the opinions that Firelap died of poisoning in the stomach. The second autopsy result from the distinguished Professor Karl Meyer, using only a few pieces of Firelap's organs, delivered the opinion that he died of simple colic. This second official autopsy and post-mortem that was carried out 4 days later was ordered by Firelap's owners and the Governor of California. Unfortunately, with all good intentions, it was a botched affair that produced conflicting results that in the end simply produced the lame, most unsatisfactory explanation of death by colic. So from the beginning, the sudden dramatic death went largely unexplained. I have found that a well-orchestrated cover-up ensured that the circumstances around how Firelap really died have never been disclosed. An unbelieving public sensed a cover-up. Australian newspaper headlines shouted, "Did the Yanks kill Firelap?" At the time and over the ensuing decades, journalists seeking attention have misquoted facts and generally botched the storyline into 100 different fables, ensuring that the mystery and the myths continue on. This was not a fitting end to what, in my opinion, was the greatest, bravest, fastest, most inspiring, charismatic, compelling horse that ever lived. As a child, I heard Tommy Woodcock's stories about the wonder horse Firelap, and I felt the devastation directly from Tommy that goes with losing such a beautiful animal, his pet, in such an atrocious way. Once I started seriously investigating the circumstances around Firelap's death, I made a promise to myself that I would unravel the mystery of what really happened to Firelap at Menlo Park, once and for all. What I have found is that Firelap's death was not an accident. At 3 a.m. on this cool San Francisco spring morning on the 5th of April, well before sunrise, low-lying night fog floated over the lush peninsular pastures of Suzanne and Edward Perry's Dream Horse Ranch. The new moon had not yet formed in the early morning sky. Instead, a moody black moon was invisible in its final lunar phase. The sky was dark without a glimmer. Here in nature's earthly cycle, the local inhabitants, whether aware or not, were on the astral cusp of endings. The early morning is still and quiet. The grass in the lush pastures is crisp and upright, having recovered in the damp night air from the previous day's grazing. The precious horses are rugged up and secure in their deluxe stables, a Hilton for horses. The Perry's property is meticulous with white painted wooden fences in the English style. On this chilly morning, could the sleeping inhabitants of the big house have any inkling of the drama about to enfold their horse haven? Ed and Suzanne are attended to by their live-in English butler, Harold Reed, and their maid, Harold's wife, Mildred. Yet despite the comfort and opulence, all in the proprietor's house is not well, particularly with Mrs. Suzanne Perry, Lady of the Manor. Suzanne is horse mad, a much married, wealthy eccentric who has inherited a fortune from her third husband, Philip Conn's untimely, early death. The usually active horsewoman with a love of animals and a multitude of activities on her calendar rarely rises from her sickbed. This is very unusual for the enthusiastic Suzanne. Her husband Ed has employed a doctor and a live-in nurse to care for her and to administer medications daily. Suzanne has become paranoid and believes that Ed is slowly poisoning her. To understand the context here, in 1932, there were very few restrictions on poisons that were freely available at the local grocery store, the irony being that Americans call their grocery stores drug stores. Anyway, with Suzanne confined to the house, it is her young Canadian husband, Ed Perry, 30 years her junior, who has befriended Farlap's part owner, Dave Davis, offering the visiting Australians the hospitality of their luxury Atherton Ranch accommodation. Two large stables nestled against massive oak trees house Suzanne Perry's straight-bred trotting horses. The second, U-shaped stable, is a temporary home to Farlap and his Australian entourage. His trainer, Aaron Trave Tommy Woodcock, jockey William Billy Elliott, track rider Jack Cashy Martin, and vet William Bill Nielsen. For security, Tommy chooses stall number 6 for Farlap in the middle of the double-storey building away from the main door. Various apartments accessible by ladder have been built into the stable lofts. It is here that Suzanne Perry's horse trainer, Clarence Hansen, lives with his wife Luella Nardine and their two children, Jay 8 and Helen 13, sharing the loft and various stable rooms with the Australian visitors. The pungent smell of tossed bedding straw, manure, and polished leather pervades their humble residence. Yet in 1930s Depression America, everyone calling this stable home considers themselves to be among the very luckiest of citizens. To them, the pervasive aroma of horses is a fragrance that embodies safety and security in a troubled economy where every second man is out of work. Half an hour earlier, at 2:30 a.m., while the family and stable hands sleep soundly in the lofts and tack rooms, Ed Perry drives Suzanne's flash car into the stable grounds, dropping Bill Nielsen back at the stables after a night of carousing and gambling at the local speakeasies, of which Ed is a popular customer. Ed and Bill have hit it off, becoming new best buddies. Farlap is resting, recovering from a hoof injury sustained on the harsh, stony Aguacaliente racetrack, and there is little for the vet to do in between racing schedules. Enjoying the spotlight and local glory of being the famed vet to one of the greatest racehorses on the planet, Bill is enjoying his moment of glory. He and Ed are stepping out every night, drinking the bootleg moonshine at John Marchbank's casino, gambling at the illegal totes, and generally enjoying the ladies of the night. Waving Ed goodnight, stumbling into the stables, Bill is falling over himself, trying to navigate the ladder up to his loft bedroom above the stalls. Not for the first time, he wakes Tommy Woodcock in the process, who, once again, helps the drunken vet up the ladder to his camp bed. Billy Elliott and Cashie Martin, Farlap's jockey and track rider, are still snoring in their camp beds, unaware of the vet's late night entrance. Clarence's family, whether they were asleep or not, are as quiet as church mice, not wanting to cause any complaint that might compromise their secure life. Grumbling to himself, Tommy gets back into his own makeshift stretcher bed beside Farlap's stall, knowing he has only another hour or two of sleep before wake-up time. Tommy rises consistently at 4:30 every morning. Life is mysterious in the way that public events and human relationships can align and intertwine in precise moments that collectively combine to bring about catastrophe. The lives of people who all play a part in the death of Farlap align in just this terrible way. At 4:30 a.m., rising from his stretcher after the interrupted night, Tommy automatically reaches his hand up to Farlap to give him his morning lump of sugar. Unusually, Farlap is not interested in taking the treat and appears listless and out of sorts. Feeling under Farlap's rug, Tommy feels the sweaty heat and suspects his horse has a temperature. Knowing the vet is comatose from the night before, Tommy nonetheless calls out to Bill Nielsen to come and take a look at Farlap. Still drunk and hungover, Bill Nielsen hazily rouses himself and manages to take Farlap's temperature. Bill announces that there isn't much to worry about, that Farlap's temperature is only slightly above normal, and asks Tommy if his horse was off his feed. Tommy replies,
"A few crumbs in the bottom, that's all."
The vet then asked if the horse's droppings were normal. "Yes, normal," replied Tommy. Bill Nielsen diagnoses that Farlap is not too bad and tells Tommy that he will mix up some medicine for him. Bill Nielsen goes away to a room in the stables where he keeps his vet bag to prepare the medication and comes back with a large horse capsule. Directing Tommy to hold Farlap's head, the vet throws the capsule down the back of Farlap's throat so it goes straight to his stomach.
And he put the medicine, big capsules, and he put it down his throat, and he said he'd be all right, he said, an hour. He said, just let him here for an hour, and he said he'd be all right, I think.
Bill Nielsen then collapses back into his loft bed. At 11 a.m, Tommy is becoming very worried. Farlap is agitated and uncomfortable. He calls Bill Nielsen again, saying that Farlap is in pain and is getting worse, not better. The vet takes another look at Farlap and instructs Tommy to walk him around the outside training track so that the medicine will go through his system more quickly. As each hour passes that morning, Farlap becomes increasingly unwell and is clearly suffering acute pain. Tommy is having difficulty keeping Farlap on his feet, but he persists with the vet's instructions and keeps him moving around outside the stable. By 12 noon, Farlap is frothing at the mouth and screeching in pain. He thrashes his large, bloated frame against the fence rails. Everyone at the stable can see the situation is calamitous. They stand by helplessly, hardly believing the unfolding tragedy. Jumping into a car, Bill Nielsen tells Tommy he is going to get another vet to come and help and drives off to fetch Dr. Cesar Macero, the Tanforan Race Club vet. Tanforan is 10 miles away, a 40 to 50 minute round trip. The vet has his own car and is a phone call away, but Nielsen decides not to take this more straightforward option. By 1 p.m, nobody has arrived to assist Tommy, who is trying to keep Farlap walking. In his anguish, the young trainer whispers comfortingly to his bobby boy, consoling his distressed horse as best he can, urging him on, comforting him. Tommy Woodcock is alone with the Australian public's hero and most loved racehorse, who is stressed and writhing in pain. Farlap is struggling to stand. Tommy is distraught. There is no one to administer any pain relief or medication to Farlap. Bill Nielsen has been gone 2 hours and has not returned with Dr. Macero. Farlap continues to squeal and thrash about. Tommy is beside himself, enduring the torture of Farlap's pain and a situation he has no control over. Nielsen could have at least given his horse some pain relief, Tommy thinks, as his eyes search the road leading away from the property. Where in hell is the bloody vet? Tommy continues to stroke Farlap's head and neck, trying to calm his horse. At around 2 p.m, struggling to keep Farlap standing, Tommy leads him back into the stall, squealing and writhing in pain. Tommy is coping with the distress of not being able to relieve his horse's pain when Farlap lets out a final agonized heave. He shrieks and falls to the stable floor, taking Tommy down with him. In a final death throw, Farlap hemorrhages blood all over his distraught young trainer. Farlap is dead, his head cradled in Tommy's lap. They are alone with the devastated stable hands looking on. Bill Nielsen has not returned. Stable hands try to remove Farlap's neck rein, but Tommy is distraught and in shock. Disbelieving and broken down crying, he will not let go of Farlap's neck. They lay a rug over Farlap and attempt to pull away the overwrought Tommy, who has just not only lost the world's greatest racehorse, but his pet and his best friend. Bill Nielsen eventually arrives back at Menlo Park with Dr. Massaro at 3:20 p.m, more than 3 hours after he had driven off. Farlap had died over an hour earlier. The stable hands forcibly pull Tommy out of the stall and away from the stable. The official time of Farlap's death is 5th of April, 1932, 2:20 p.m. Bill Nielsen left Tommy alone with a distraught Farlap. Why did the vet not simply get on the phone to the expert Tamforan racecourse vet, Dr. Massaro? The shocking truth is that Bill Nielsen was not searching out the vet, but in a local bar, drinking.
He did feel responsible to some extent, because he wasn't there, you see, when the horse fell ill. He'd have gone into town.
What did he go into town for?
Well, just to have a few drinks, I think, or to you know, socialise a bit.
I'm Kerry Nagara, and this is Killing Farlap, a forensic investigation. Technical producer is Richard Di Gregorio.
Hi, Richard here. We'll be putting up 2 episodes every week of Kerry's amazing investigation, Killing Farlap. There are 9 episodes in all, so make sure you subscribe and the episodes will automatically come into your podcast library. We welcome any feedback and comments and hope if you enjoy the podcast, you will give us a star rating and review. Thanks for listening.